All right, this is number 31 in our series, which is now about a year old, church history, about in October. So we're into October. One more week in October. Next week is Halloween night. I'm sure it won't keep anybody home. I scribbled a lot of things on the board, and I do that because I have to do something while I wait for you to show up. So I could do the board and not do my lesson. That would be okay. But it doesn't necessarily, it goes with my lesson, but doesn't mean I necessarily have to refer to it, although I will refer to these 6 points over here on your right. So remind you why we study history. If you don't know this, it helps you appreciate the past. I mean, the past isn't just some lucky event, you know, it's where God worked. So, you know, if you get excited what God's doing in our day, you can look back and see what God did in yesteryear, or whatever the word is. So it is exciting, and the more you know about it, the more you see God's hand in things. So we are in a relatively close time. We're moving the needle closer to our present day. We started around 1650, around there, and we're bumping past or into 1900. We go a little bit past today, so we're going to hover around here for at least one more week. We have to go back and pick up some of the liberal thinking that was going on during this time. So today we're going to stick pretty much with, I call it the four safety nets. If Gild can literate his sermons, I can give you 4 points. So I don't have lined up with literation, though, so I could have done that, I guess. So the four nets are the bottom on my list here. We have the awakening of 1857. I'll explain this in a minute. The Moody's Evangelism. We have the Bible Conference, the Bible Institutes, and then the Scofield Reference Bible, and then the Fundamentals of the Faith being published. I think I call those the safety nets, sort of like, you know, like the boats the Lord sent by to salvage civilization, and they went by and no one got on them, or not enough got on them. So I call them the safety nets. We're going to construct our chart by adding to the side of it, which is, if you could look back here on the right-hand side, I don't have my pointer up here. We're just going to extend it now over, so we're going to pick up on the era of the revivals, and that goes into fundamentalism. Below it is modernism, and we're going to still keep them together, at least we're going to show them together before 1900. Don't have a pointer. Before 1900, you have to pick it out on the board. But as you hit 1900, friction increases greatly between these two groups, and that friction will finally break apart the groups around the Scopes Monkey Trial, 1925 to 1930. So that pink in there is friction. The groups are together before 1900. Virtually all are still in the Presbyterian congregational churches, Episcopal churches, Methodist churches. They are together. You know, Moody wasn't a great theologian, so there wasn't church planning going on. He wasn't a church planner, so it wasn't groups coming out. So they pretty well stay together. And I'll tell you later if I don't forget to, but there was not a highly defined theology like we have today. You know, you can go down our list. We believe the virgin birth, the inerrancy of Scripture, the resurrection. You know, we just go down the list and know what they are. But those days, they weren't so sure which one of these are that important. I'm sure some of them they understood were important, but just put them together in a systematic form was probably not as we would do it today, and therefore there was a little more looseness to it. But once you get to 900, I think it's Arnold Gabelline, and we'll see his name later, when he leaves the denominational church, it sort of shakes the waves up, and people start to think, well, maybe we should too. And so we have the next 20 years where that question goes on. By the time you get to 1930, it's pretty well decided. If you haven't left, you'll be kicked out. So the pressure is building during this time. So let's say on the bottom, unite or divide is the question. At this point, or at about 1900, it is. So the safety nets. Now, a little bit of review here. The contribution of the 19th century, we've talked about that just in America. It gives us the 20th century. And I've said the 19th century probably is the greatest century of all time. That doesn't mean the evangelicals didn't have their own century, and that would probably be the 20th century, probably the first half of the 20th century. So we're going to deal with that as we run through it, and maybe we'll change our mind about that. But I think kind of we can say that, and then we'll have reasons for it. So what made this possible, this age, golden age of the evangelicals? Well, we've talked at length of the 19th century America, where for the first time, unfettered opportunities of personal freedom brought scientific and economic innovation, with it wealth building. And religion became a personal choice, and it was, in a sense, one of the liberties that we got in our founding of our country. And when people had liberty to, you know, innovate, they did that in religion, and some of the cults came out of this era as well. So for the first time since 1890, the number date you can remember is since 1850, since the early church times, let's pick 280 or somewhere in there, that a literal understanding of the Bible was accepted as the standard for the second half of the century in the new Bible schools and in much of the preaching. And when I say literal, I just picked out here a definition of the millennium. Well, the millennium occurs after the tribulation, Armageddon, the second coming, judgment of Israel, the nations, Matthew 19, Matthew 24, 25. I didn't make this up. So I just picked it up. So I put it up on the internet. I just figured, well, there's an example of something literal. Satan is bound. He's cast in a bottomless pit, sealed for a duration of 1,000 years, yet released at the end of millennium for a short time to rally unbelievers versus Jesus, King Jesus. And he calls it Armageddon number 2. Now, I read my Bible literally, and that's what I understand to say. I don't know who wrote this. And he reads his Bible literally, comes up with the same answer. See, now that is kind of refreshing. That was kind of new after 1850. So from the early 19th century, it took 40 to 50 years, you know, depends on what you want to figure here, for the implications of a literal Bible to grab the imagination of the evangelicals. Remember, it started with Darby, so it took a while for that to catch on. It took the challenge of modernism, Schleiermacher, remember him in Germany, to spawn the intense inquiry into the meaning of the Bible. Is Schleiermacher right? The Bible really isn't that reliable after all. There's things in it that we really don't believe anyway, like the death and burial, resurrection, all of Christ. That's really not part of our core Christianity. Well, if somebody says that to you, that drives you to the Word, and that's what happened here. So this inquiry was the force that formed the Bible Conference Movement starting in 1875. So literalism gave them an indispensable tool they did not have before. Remember, they didn't think of the Bible as a literal book, talked about it as an allegorical book with literal things in it. So literalism gave them an indispensable tool which unlocked, which is a strange word to literal, but in a sense for them it unlocked the real meaning of it when it became plain for all, not scholars, to see. Though anybody could read this, just like it read that passage out of Revelation, they could read it for themselves, whether they were in America or in England, they come up with the same answer, all right? So in a sense, it unlocked the scripture because it was kind of like hidden before them, before their very eyes. You know, somebody hid something in the room that you didn't know where it was right before their eyes, and you had to point it out to them, and they didn't see it. So that kind of thing. So this new personal freedom, which is in the 19th century, eventually will be used then in Christianity to actually establish new churches, because the old churches were found to be unreliable or not really teaching the truth. Now, the innovation, a fresh inquiry into the true message or meaning of the Bible, could only happen when the shackles of the prevailing allegory was broken. You had to get rid of that allegory. And that was before 1850. But with the new tool, the concept of literal, the Bible clearly spoke to the hearts and minds of the Christian leaders. In fact, it's so obvious, you wonder why he didn't do it before. So this mysterious book that used to lay on our shelf quietly all of a sudden explodes with divine light. And the only way I can explain this, and this is not exactly a same parallel, but I know when Gil came in 69, that I'd been in the evangelical church all my life, and the Bible was honored and revered and taught from. But when he started telling us about things that we didn't understand, like we all had questions, as you probably have been through this, all had questions. And I just figured those questions will never be answered. They're just the way it is in the Bible. You just don't know. But he started ticking them off. This answer and this answer and this answer. It's almost like the Bible exploded with this information. All right, so that's kind of what happened in this time. So that God had spoken, now even about the future, was a revolutionary idea. It straightened out the fatal skid in an instant of time. Like you're driving down the road, you're in a skid, you correct it straight. That's what the literal reading did for them, does for us. The Bible now is a book of predictable precepts and prophecies. You could read it for what it says. We could look at the history and say, that's what happened. We could look into the prophecy and say, well, that happened. We had said it was going to happen. That's been fulfilled. Now we expect anything that's in the future will happen just as it was prophesied to be fulfilled. So with this, we now had a new disarming sure-footedness about the truth that makes some uncomfortable. It's kind of difficult when somebody says, I know what the Bible says, and you don't know what it says. So lest we paint an inaccurate picture here, there were evangelical laggards who continued to hang on to historic theology, that is, the theology that was given to them from the church fathers, I call them the juveniles, and they had great authority in the minds of these some believers. The idea that Christians were in the tribulation was from the early church days. Obviously, they had a lot of, there were 10 Roman persecutions, and the worst of them was under Diocletian just before 300 AD. And so they thought and had reason to think they were in a tribulation, and they thought they were. But they had to read the Bible figuratively to make that work. So the idea that Christians were in the tribulation from the early church days gave us community, the variant of a mid or post-tribulational rapture. And these people that saw themselves in the tribulation in 1900 or 1875 failed also to instate the Jewish prophecies. So see, well, one thing happens, another thing happens. So these things compound. So they were all perfectly on the same page. And we'll talk more about that as we go. These, for now, the ones that were not quite right with this yet, maybe mid-trip, post-trip, these now maintain the gospel. At least they got a claim of the gospel, which was challenged under Schleiermacher. These, for now, maintain the gospel and the historic theological errors. Rejecting the Jewish promises, they continue to maintain covenant theology. And most of these that will emerge that we will remember will be the Presbyterians. Now, some of you old people will remember one Presbyterian dispensationalist, Bruce Dunn, at Peoria, Illinois. And he was a dispensational Presbyterian. So there may have been others, but this is the one that people knew, and he was had, you know, somewhat national fame because he was on the radio and all television and that stuff. So my point here is basically they were all dispensational, except an exception here that Presbyterians hung on. So there were some that had this error. You know, they thought they were in the tribulation, and they didn't give up the covenant theology. Those two go together. You figuratively read the Bible, you're going to come up with those errors. So they continued to reject, in the midst of these people that are taking the Bible literally, there were some that didn't. They continued to reject the literal tool, and in a dangerous way left the door open, keeping the poison pill, infant baptism, going. Waited for a repeat apostasy in the modern church, which I think has come to roost in our days. Because people are starting now, that are covenantal, starting to reject or question the early chapters of Genesis. So that's what happens. It just sort of can't stay put. All right, so the first one of our safety nets that's coming by here is the Bible Conference movement. And we've talked a little bit about this, but I want to do at least one setting. The Bible Conference movement started in 1875, lasted into the 20th century, and the prevailing theology that was taught in these conferences was dispensational. It doesn't mean that everyone that spoke there was, but there was a prevailing sentiment, and the guy that ran the Niagara-on-the-Lake conference was James Brooke from St. Louis, strongly dispensational, and probably somewhat managed the speaker's chart and kept them probably on target. Now, remember, if you don't know this, the great attraction of dispensationalism was that it provided for the first time a picture of the plan or operation of God in its entirety. You know, we still have a little bit of problem with that. We somehow think that all God is doing is saving people. And when God's done saving people, it's all over. No, there's a lot of things God's doing besides saving people. And dispensationalism gives you the rationale for that. So that's why I put this on the chart, the top one. I always call the chart has texture. You know, there's things that happen on the chart. From the church on, we have sacrifice of Christ on, we have the church age. We have the tribulation. It's a different thing. It's going back to Jewish promises. And then we have the 1,000-year of the millennium. Then we have the eternity that continues. But if you look down, you see the church and culture now is the amillennial or postmillennial view. It's flat. There's nothing happens. After death of Christ, nothing happens. It's until it's over, boom, it's done. So it's just sort of like one event. So it has no texture. Therefore, some of the things that the Bible talks about aren't noted as the dispensations do, and that's why we have a little texture there. So the real attraction of dispensationalism was that it provided for the first time a picture of the plan and operation of God. That is, what is God doing in the world besides saving people? And finally, there was an answer to that. But not everybody is happy with this simple, straightforward approach to Scripture. And I'm jumping forward a little bit to our time. So we want to pause a little bit to explain, as it comes to our time, the idea of prophetic surety bothers some people. And I think I know why. The idea that God is predictable in concrete terms strikes some as fearfully wrong and repulsive, rejecting our charts and maps. I've been made fun of. That's fine. But why is it that the idea that God has revealed the future so feared and rejected by so many Christians? Well, I think the reason is that God, who reveals the future, obligates the creature to ponder the future. That is his choices. Rejecting that, he would rather assume an Allah type God who doesn't know the future, doesn't meddle with the future, doesn't tell us about the future, and the future is just a big, I'm going to say word luck here, but just don't know what's going to happen. So they would assume an Allah type God who has not obligated himself to the future, meaning I have no duty to prepare for it. And I got to say, there's a few of them out there are just too lazy to study to find out how it really works. So for a time in the middle of the late 19th century, the allegorical or spiritualization of the text was suspended in most cases. Even by the covenant people, they sort of, took a breath. Again, most of the teachers at the conference were dispensational, but there was diversity. Look at this. There were Presbyterians, Methodists, Episcopal, congregation, and so forth. Pastors who agreed on the literal meaning, therefore most were dispensational, but this has slipped in time, as we know. Now, remember what the driving factors were here for these conferences. The modernist challenge to the Bible's truth fostered a new literalism in reading it. We have to find out what's right. Allegory just does not have any power to persuade, because there's many ideas of allegory. The meaning of allegory is there are people in the room, and that doesn't persuade. The truth that Jesus will return in the clouds is much more compelling if we think of it by expecting it in the atmosphere versus a subjective expression of it in the heart, which is personal and of little interest to others. That's why it doesn't stick. An allegory just has no reason to obey it or pay attention to it. So as we said, when the football team gets set back, they huddle to plan the next move. So the conferences were those huddles to sharpen and define all theology. Especially new was the eschatology when reading the Bible. So small beginnings in Niagara at Swampscott, I don't know where that is, New York, I think, soon mushroomed with conference grounds being set up all over the country. And from the Montrose summer gatherings in the Pennsylvania mountains to the Broadwalk Bible Conference in Atlantic City, the movement swept America with a unique vacation package. That was kind of a nice little deal. You go someplace for vacation at Bible conference. Wow, that's pretty good. With scenery and resort living all together. Their outstanding fundamentalist leader spoke, such as Ironside, who was pastor at Moody Church, Paul Rood from Biola. We have M.R. DeHaan, and I remember him still on the air when we came to Lincoln, Radio Bible class, William Riley, the Baptist guy from Minneapolis, Reuben A. Torrey, who was sidekick of Moody, who was the second president of Moody, who addressed the first meeting of the World's Christian Fundamentalist Association, which we will talk about probably soon, not maybe next week, another organization of fundamentalists. So the longest lived of the great Bible conferences was in Winona Lake, Indiana, not far from where Gill went to seminary. It was started by Reverend Solomon Dickey, called Saul Dickey. Saul, superintendent of the Presbyterian Church's Home Missions Department. It differed from the earlier conferences like Niagara because it incorporated the elements of the Chautauqua movement. We had that last week. I didn't know anything about that, so I was educated during the interim, and it fell in my lap. I didn't have to go look for it. Now, Chautauqua was a program of educational, religious, and cultural enrichment activities that Methodist Bishop Vincent inaugurated in Chautauqua, New York, 1874. Now, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, this is a liberal approach to the gospel. But I don't know. It apparently was, but it was very much integrated even with the gospel in some places, and which I'll talk about. But it, since the roots come out of Methodism and so forth, you sort of wonder, this is just one of those moral aspects, again, that you know people enjoyed. And again, since the theology wasn't all that defined in this time, there was a lot of this ecumenism that was going on and not a clear thinking about, well, this isn't right and we won't do participate with that. It had to be more like it had to be outright wrong else to participate. So there was an agreement here. So beginning with the simple Sunday school convention, Vincent expanded the work to include lectures, artistic offerings, such as plays, concerts, correspondence school, and regular summer school courses. Soon others sprang up around the country. To me, it had nothing to do with the Bible at this point. Now, Dickey observed this and incorporated an added agricultural and technical institute, a college, and numerous summer school courses from law to pottery, making with the full Chautauqua style of lectures, concerts, and plays. Now, Winona, Chautauqua eventually featured speakers like Helen Keller, Will Rogers, Richard Burr, John Philip Sousa. As time advanced, assembly sought to control this at the Winona Lake grounds and make it into a Christian resort area by building hotels, summer cottages, and offering various family entertainments. Now, it was said in the beginning, it was that Winona always has been a spiritual conference. Presbyterian. Saul Dickey wanted to organize it along the lines of Moody's Northfield Conference. So at Moody's suggestion, the director, William Chapman, was under him. It was under his leadership that the conference succeeded in attracting some of the best preachers in America, Canada, and England. Chapman left in 1907, but Dickey continued to carry on the tradition set by Chapman. And these are just pictures of that. You know, this one happened to be in Minnesota. Do you know of people in your family that went to these things?
Yes.
Really?
I remember my dad talking about it.
Yeah. All right, so that was one. The Bible Conference movement is a big influence in the country. And they were not only in Niagara, they were in New York and so forth. In some ways, they continue today, because I'm going to a Bible conference in December. So this is still carried on in some ways. And you go to the Bible conference, like the preacher conference, they'll tell you about others that are going on. We just don't hear about them. We're so far out of the beaten path up here that we don't hear. But you go down Texas way, there's a lot of schools down there, and a lot of the schools have conferences. So I'm saying it was a formidable force in society where you could go and get instructed in the Bible and in dispensational theology by and large. Okay, now out of the conference now comes the next thing, schools, the next safety net. Backing up a little bit, there was a decline in the divinity students in the schools established by the Puritans in 1836, Harvard. We have then Harvard failed and Yale was started, Princeton was started. You know, these are kind of like dominoes. When one failed, they start another one. So these schools were established to prepare men for ministry, and the majority of these students graduated in the 17th century, entered the ministry. More than half of them entered the ministry. But by the time 1750 comes along, 100 years later, it dropped to half of them. And by 1800, another 50 years, only 22%. By the time you get to 1900, only 6% were going into the ministries. You see that the schools have ceased to be divinity schools. With modernism taking over the schools and churches, as we will see, those faithful to the Bible saw a need again to start schools that prepared men for the ministry. This was the pattern from Harvard to Yale. School drifted to intellectualism, that is, and it seems to me, scholarship or theology. One of the few new schools to be formed was the liberal arts school at Wheaton, Illinois, which we still know as Wheaton, 1860. I didn't realize it was that old. It enjoyed phenomenal growth, but many evangelical leaders felt that America needed another type of school, not a liberal arts school. So an institute, not necessarily an accredited school. But our study of evangelicals show that the shaping of the movement was not primarily an academic one. I think this is one of those, it's not a kept secret, but it's really interesting that most of what we see in this period of time is not brought to us by your local professor. It's brought to you by the normal guy in the street or the pastor, perhaps. The ideas of holding on to the truth did not come from the halls of higher learning, but from the workers in the street, the pastors of the churches who felt themselves personally the cold wind of liberalism. We'll make this point later again, but it is amazing how much of the defense of the gospel during this period came from the lay people untrained by the academy. Well, one of the first ones, besides Wheaton, we have this Talmage. I don't know anything about him. His school died with him. But we have one that we still have, NIAC New York, is a Christian Missionary Alliance started by A.B. Simpson. It was also, at that time, we have Moody starting with the Moody Bible Institute, we call it, in 1886. So that's the early ones. Now, during the 45 years between the founding of A.B. Simpson Institute at NIAC to the establishment of Bob Jones in 1927, some 55 Bible institutes or colleges were formed. At first, they attracted non-high school graduates. Now, they're just people didn't have to have any credentials. All you do is be able to do the work, and you go to school. So at first, they attracted non-high school graduates, but then full-time students as curriculums expanded from 2 to 3 and 4 years, even possibly some places, accredited degrees were offered. Now, Bob Jones, the last one, was the most academically oriented and formed in 1927, really to combat modernism, almost another, you know, attempt at stopping the wave of modernism by doing it through the schools. Later, Bob Jones in Greenville, South Carolina, became the lightning rod of the fundamentalists. Some of us are old enough to remember him yet, and all the controversy he always stirred with the things he would say. And they ran the school, as I see in the bottom here, they were closely a school of conformity, and sometimes they drew the charge of legalism, which I think a school can't be legalistic. It's just a school, and when you're in school, it's going to be legalistic. So anyway, he's charged with this sometimes. But they were often cited further backward. Biblical stanzas and usually charged with small-minded backwardness. Another much later school also established to combat modernism was Liberty University in 1971, jumping way ahead, Falwell School. It also stood as the target of the left to discredit Bible-believing Christians. Now, there's an issue of accreditation. In time, some of these schools achieved academic accreditation, credentials and academic accreditations, but most did not and remained Bible colleges or institutes with their own reputation. You went to a school because of the reputation and because it had credentials. There was no issue unless the student, this really was no issue unless the student wanted to transfer to an accredited school or to a seminary, and then the institute credits were lost. I know that some of my friends from Henderson went to Grace College for a year, and they wanted to transfer. I went to Tabor, so I went to transfer to Tabor. Well, the credits wouldn't transfer because Tabor was an accredited school, but Grace Bible was not. So a lot of people went there just, I'm going to lose the credits. I just want the Bible training. Don't worry about the credits. So that's kind of an issue for some people. And then to get the accreditation, of course, is another deal because they have to do certain things, which I'm going to say here in a minute. The issue of accreditation can be a dangerous trap in the quest for recognition using humanistic standards. But the practice continues as the accepted goal. Every school wants to be accredited. Well, some of the significant schools, we have the Toronto Bible College, Practical Bible Training. That one I don't know. Northwestern Bible College, my son-in-law, Scott, went there. Toccoa Falls Bible in Georgia. Don't know that one. Bible Institute of Los Angeles with Biola. Yes. Northwestern. Okay. Well, Northwestern was also the school where Billy Graham served as president for a short time, so before he went on to the road being an evangelist. So, Biola in Los Angeles, Philadelphia College of Bible, Gill attended that. We have Prairie Bible Institute. I know some of our church attended that. I don't know if any of you did. So, in 1930, just as a summary here, in 1930, there were 50 schools recommended. That doesn't mean there were more. But they recommended, by this association, 50 schools that were in the major cities and became the voice of nonconformist fundamentalists. As you have that many schools, that many cities, there's going to be some impact. Just for your information, Grace College of the Bible was established quite late, 1943. It was kind of established by Mennonites, if you knew that or not. But, you know, it ceased really to be that. But now it's defunct. They quit functioning in this last year in May. You know, Calvary Bible, called Calvary Institute, now it's called Calvary University in Kansas City, where Tommy Ice is. It was formed in 1932 and still functions with about 400 students. But it's gone through renovation and, you know, some absorption of other schools and, you know, groupings. So, but they still call themselves Calvary. And I think probably from what I can tell, probably a good school. If anybody's looking for a place to go, that'd be solid dispensational, and they still are. Now, just for fun. I have the others that are out there, and there's more that need to be added to this list because there's some new upstarts. Grace Seminary, where Gil Gwent was born, started in 1937, a magic year. Dallas Seminary, where Schaefer was, 1924. Well, Western, which is a conservative Baptist school, 1927. Talbot was independent. I'm not sure where they came out of, 1952, and then Masters came out of Talbot, and that's independent, 1986. And there's a number of other smaller schools that even some of our people are doing online work. So they're sort of developing another whole new way of doing things in school, and a lot of it with home studies. So anyway, these are all dispensational schools, more or less now. Now, the schools are significant in the propagation of evangelical truth, most often with a dispensational theology. Now, doesn't mean there weren't other schools, there were, but I'm just talking about those. Many young men after high school received their training at these schools and entered the ministry without further education. And I might say at this point that those schools, I'm saying men, those schools largely had, half of them were women. So I mean, it wasn't like girls couldn't go to these schools. They could go to these schools. All right, so I'm just kind of talking about preparing for pulpit ministry. They came out of these schools and went right into the pulpits. Some chose a year at this Bible school before entering a career or moving to a higher, to places of higher education. Just give you some examples of that. Mission preparation was placed equal with the pastorate in some cases, and in some cases placed above local ministries. So missions is very, very important. The impact of these schools on the lay and professional ministers cannot be overstated. Now I'm going to throw this in here, and I'm going to run out of time tonight, but that's okay. We only at 40. We've got to go to 70. We'll never make it. But we have another week next week. I want to just talk a little bit about missions. I want to talk about them because they got to fit somewhere. Because missions is a big deal coming out of this, or in this. One of the great products of the rediscovery of Bible truth via normal reading of the Bible was a sense that time was escaping, or that we're escaping time, whatever. God had revealed the future in some surprising detail. The details of this meant that time was running out. The 11th hour had arrived. And the evangelicals, now armed with the clarification of the gospel, got that straight, as a personal matter, which necessitated a person's confrontation. The urge to carry the message to all the nation was a product of the Bible Conference, Bible Institute movement, often held for the same purpose. Now, A.B. Simpson, in his school and in his churches, have missionary in their name. We still have Christian Missionary Alliances in churches in town. I think there's two. I don't know if they still call them that. Rosemont is a Christian Missionary Alliance church. Central was. They call it something else now. City Light. Okay, that sounds right. So I don't know whether to continue to hold Christian Missionary Alliance attachments, but it was down 27th and 29th and O. Okay. So Christian Missionary Alliance was built to be a missions church. Now, the calling of the church built somewhat on a misreading of Matthew 28:20, where it talks about that the gospel shall be taken to the ends of the earth and also to the end of the age, is now read somehow that if the gospel is preached, then the end shall come. That's take Matthew 28:20 and wedding with Matthew 24:14, sort of makes that there is, the Lord can't come until the gospel is preached to the whole world, which is really borrowed from post-millennial theology. But there's a lot of that impetus behind missions. And I sometimes wonder that God uses a wrong idea to motivate people to do the right thing. I don't know. I don't want to criticize people for going to missions because God obviously control all this. So this is a bit of borrowing from post-millennial theology that the gospel must be preached everywhere and then the Lord could come idea. Nonetheless, often foreign missionary endeavors were seen as more lofty and important than home missions. And I've been in discussions where they have held that a missionary is higher than a pastor. I mean, there's almost awestruck by this. And I don't want to make judgment about that because the Bible doesn't. While this is not a study about foreign missions, it is a fact that the evangelicals confirmed the Bible as written word with its obligations of evangelism aimed at the creature, individual, by preaching the gospel to every creature. That was no doubt about that. That motivated him. For this reason, God raised up missionaries to carry forth the message to the entire world. At the Bible schools, they had strong missionary recruitment component, I think probably in all of them. Some were even built for that purpose. Now we have missionary agencies that now I think have all got new names. I wish they keep their old names, but somehow they think it's more up to date to get a new name. I think it hurts them. So we have the Christian Missionary Alliance. We have the China Inland Mission, Hudson Taylor. We have the team. We have quite a few, like Dan Harder was out on her team, and Sharon Harder was out on her team. Those mission, now they call it the Avant. I think they call it something like that. The SIM, Sudan Interior Mission, I think has a new name. African Interior Mission has a new name too. So sometimes they broaden their mission activity and they have to change their name. Often these agencies were interdenominational agencies. You know, you could be Baptist, you know, Methodist, you could participate in these by funding them because it was a faith mission. These missions were funded by voluntary giving that was not necessarily part of the church budget. They went around recruiting, kind of like campaigning for support, and when they got the support, they go onto the field, and when they lost the support, they have to come home and get some more money, you know, some more support. So that's what I mean with faith missions. They are often interdenominational agencies. All used evangelism, the model, all used evangelism, medical, educational model to meet the needs of the whole man. And that whole thing is a whole series of discussion that someday, if I live enough, I'd like to have with somebody. So we do not claim that missionary efforts began with the Bible conferences, although faith missions did, only that they were better. They had a better grasp of the gospel, considering the modernist challenge, when going as missionaries. They knew why they were going. This does not out of moral imperatives of postmillennialism make the world better. That's not why they went. They went with the gospel to convert. So this postmillennialism was there earlier, and it was somewhat a surge for evangelical missionaries in the early years of the 19th century. It's hard to know exactly because that was the theology. Now, Herbert Kane, in his book, The Concise History of Christian Missions, a little older book, 1976, says this about the missionaries. Of the missionaries in the early 19th century, it could be said that what they may have lacked by way of intellectual prowess, they made up in Christian character. And that's kind of the ideal I had before about, you know, you don't get trained by the intellectuals, you get trained by the man in the street, and which is going to be more effective. So these people didn't have the ability to perhaps parse the Greek, but they could learn the languages and share the gospel with the natives. And that was something they wanted to do and were not kept from doing because they weren't scholars. Almost without exception, the missionaries of the 19th century were men and women of deep conviction and compassion. They believed that the heathen were lost without the knowledge of Jesus Christ. They spared no pains to take the gospel to the lost and dying. And for them, the hardest thing was to hear was the reaction to their message. As a rule, the missionaries were not wanted, not liked, not trusted. Frequently, their message was rejected. It is a mistake to think that the heathen in his blindness is just waiting for the missionary to bring him the light. He is blind, all right, and he doesn't know it. Consequently, he is in no hurry to embrace the light. Sometimes you hear this in our songs, in the missionary songs, they're just waiting for us to come. And that's probably wrong. It would be a miscarriage of the truth there. So he says it pretty plainly. So in country after country, these missionaries had to wait many years for the seed to take root in good ground. Death claimed an abnormal number of missionaries, especially in Africa. The big killers were malaria, yellow fever, typhus, and dysentery. The story of missions in Africa is an amazing tale of adventure, privation, sickness, weakness, and death. Missionaries served in the spirit of Melville Cox, who died within 4 months of arriving in Liberia in 1833. He said, "Let 1,000 fall before Africa be given up." One reason for calling the 19th century the Great Century is that it produced so many great missionaries. No other period in Christian history produced as a galaxy of missionary giants. In a listing of these 2,286 missionary biographies, all belong to the 19th century. Well, we find much more to explore here with the missions, but missionary efforts were a product of the time. But the missionary effort didn't reshape the modernism fundamentals, the struggle. But the modernism fundamental struggle affected missions around 1930 when the split occurred. So we'll take up that later. All right. So our next lifesaver, another uneducated theologian who had a vision for the helpful tool, was C.I. Schofield. And I dug out my C.I. Schofield Bibles. And they're getting old by just laying there. I'm not using them, but I don't want them to fall apart either. Here we could have a whole lesson on this. I mean, a whole series on this because it's our Bible. It's how we approach the Bible. That's the Scofield Bible. All right. So let's talk about it. In 1901, in Seacliffe Conference, New York, Cyrus Ingerson Scofield mentioned to A.C. Arnold C. Gabelline his plan to produce a reference Bible. Scofield wants to produce a reference Bible. He tells us to Gabelline. Scofield had hoped for some time that the conference may bring, that he was at, would bring about such a publication. You know, there would be some interest there because these are Bible people here. A reference to Bible was a reference Bible with copious notes to explain the meaning was his intention. Well, next year, 1902, Scofield finalized his plans. The two wealthy laymen, John T. Peer, who owned the conference facility at Seacliff, and Alwyn Ball, Jr., served as the financial sponsors for the conference. Pierre, the owner of the Carson Pierre Scott building in Chicago, and by the way, I've got some help for you if you want to go look at this place, housing the department store by the same name, a building designed by the famous architect introducing modern architecture was Lewis Sullivan. So there's a picture of it, and it's still standing. This is the Lewis Sullivan's Carson Pierre Scott building and the department store constructed in two stages, 1900, so on. Sullivan, again, a little bit of architecture for you. Got to do this for you. Sullivan's building is an important example of early Chicago skyscraper architecture and can also be seen as a facilitating indicator of relationship between architecture and commerce. You know, all the building had all these kind of things, apartments on the top, you know, retail store below and offices in the middle, you know, just like what we think about today. All right, so this is new for those days. The firm of Adler and Sullivan first became known in Chicago in the early 1880s for the design of the auditorium, the Sullivan Auditorium, still standing, I think, and other landmarks utilizing new methods of steel construction and a uniquely American blend of Art Nouveau decoration with a simplified monumentality. And now we have the development of cable-hung elevators rather than hydraulically run, so you can have these multi-story buildings that all had to go together. Well, Pierre, he's owner of this building. Owner Peer helped to finance the Scofield Bible. Now, that's kind of what the interest part is. If you want to know where the building is, you know Chicago. On top is where Moody Bible Institute is, and down below, across the river, Chicago River, is where this building is, about five blocks south of the river. So sometime when you're up there for a Cubs game, you might want to look up the building because it's quite gorgeous. Okay, a New York real estate broker, the other person, a member of the South Tack and Ball organization, Ball with his friends, Francis Fritsch, had kept alive their prayer meeting started in 1857 on the list up here. All right, so we have all these connections that are so interesting. In the beginning of the million conversions across the land in, I think, what, 2 years. These two men were used of God to produce the single most influential publication in fundamentalism's history, the Scofield Reference Bible. C.I. Scofield, born in Michigan, raised in Tennessee, served in Lee's Army in the Civil War. Scofield served as U.S. attorney, as a lawyer, and practiced law in St. Louis, converted to Christ at age 36, sat on a minister of James Brooks. And James Brooks was the guy that kept the gate at the Niagara Bible Conference to make sure that the dispensationalists got on board. All right, so that's who he is. So Scofield got his teeth cut under Brooks in the Washington Avenue Presbyterian Church, St. Louis. Scofield served as pastor and of the First Congregational Church. Now it's Scofield Memorial Church in Dallas, Texas, and it's not at its original location. It's now moved from downtown to somewhere else, and that church is not to be confused with First Baptist Church, which is also downtown. I had to work hard to get those things straightened out of my mind. That's where Jeffries is today. All right, just for fun, Lewis Berry Schaefer, the first president of Dallas Seminary, was senior pastor of Scofield Memorial Church in the 20s. So, again, another connection. And he becomes the founding president of Dallas Seminary. And he was a Presbyterian. And with him comes a little bit of the confused higher life theology, which some of us have struggled with men that have come from Dallas. Not all of them, just some of them. And if you know what higher life stuff is, talk to me later, I'll tell you. It's not a bad thing, it's just not right. All right, so we have that tied in with Scofield. Not done yet. At D.L. Scofield, Moody's request, Scofield served as the pastor of East Northampton, Massachusetts, just a few blocks from where, or maybe a mile from where Jonathan Edwards preached. A little later, of course. Now, this is not where Jonathan Edwards ministered. That was, but 25, 20, 34 miles south of Northfield. That's where Moody was. Eastfield is that south of Northfield, where Moody made his home. Now, Moody had him come up there. He was within 35 miles of him, so you see why he did that. Well, now, Moody died in 1899, so Scofield was ministering near Moody in the last years of Moody's life. Now, the consultants on the notes, if you take a Bible, you'll see these names there. We have different versions. We have the 1909, 1917, 1967 version of the Scofield Reference Bible. So they're not exactly like. They make these updated versions are noted that way. But we have Henry Weston, Cozier Seminary. By the way, a graduate of that school is Martin Luther King Jr. And we have James Gray, the president, third president of Moody Bible Institute. Now, these are people that contributed to the Scofield Bible. William Morehouse from Xenia College Seminary was a post-tribulational guy, post-trib guy. Elmore Harris, Toronto Bible Institute. William Erdman, who goes on to establish the publishing company, the Erdmans, was also a post-tribulationalist guy. And we have Arnold Gabelline, you mentioned him before, and he's a dispensationalist, but he's an anti-Zionist dispensationalist. So this, he died in, are you following this? Well, it can work this way because he said, well, he died in 46, so he didn't get to see 48, so he almost got there. I'm not sure that would make any difference. He thought that whatever the Jews were doing today was under their own steam. God had nothing to do with it. And he didn't read Ezekiel 38 and see they came back as dead bones. So anyway, it's interesting that here the dispensationalist is an anti-Zionist, which is kind of an anomaly. Then Pearson followed Spurgeon in London. So all were speakers at the IRA conferences. These guys all were speakers at the conferences. All were consulted, but it is not known exactly how their scholarship was used. It doesn't say how they were used. Maybe just read over it or whatever, or if they wrote some of it, we don't know. Now, that there were two post-tribulationalists in this dispensational Bible is a little strange, but it indicates Scofield's desire not to keep the issue from dividing friends. Remember, we have a little looser theology here than we're used to. But post-tribulationalism does not find expression in the notes. So Scofield held it together. And so it's published in 1909 first. Now, the Bible follows a pre-tribulational, pre-millennial scheme like we are. Scofield, a la Darby, probably divided the creation into the seven dispensations like I guess we do. I don't have a problem with that. He mapped out the covenants of the Bible, noting the conditional covenants and the unconditional covenants, which is very important. This obviously simple scheme, for the first time, gave a coherent picture of the Bible, as I said in the beginning. Now, without contradictions or ambiguities, common in any attempt in assuming an allegorical Bible. It was really quite straightforward. Now, it doesn't mean it's easy to learn. But you don't have to say, well, I just don't understand how that would work. You know, well, the tribulation occurs in this. It's understandable, and you go to a line, verse, chapter to make your point. So, simply said, the Bible has answers based on literal meanings, which then this opens vistas never seen before. Now, is that what it's, remember, I went to Gill's office when I was teaching Romans 8, when he came and says, I know what this says here about the electing work of God, but I know what it says, but that's not what it means. See? But that's not what it means. And he said, what do you think he said? That's what it means. So, you mean what it says is what it means? That was a new thought. I mean, on that issue it was. So just multiply that on other issues. All right. So this opens new vistas that never seen before. Now, it was not scholarly speculation, but observations built on an expectation that if God intended to communicate, he would be restricted, folks, to the literal written text. You know, there's no other options here. If he intends to communicate, he's going to have to do it in writing. Nothing else works. So, historic postmillennial theology had to give way to the literal text. And those that didn't do it, which I said before, postmillennial, mid-tribbers or whatever, post-tribbers, mid-tribbers, didn't do that. They abandoned the literal text. Remember, they said they're in the tribulation. Well, to make the early church in the tribulation, you got to spiritualize the seventh week of Daniel. Just can't do it literally. So anyway, it makes you honest is what it does. Now, with the Scofield Bible, some errata. As we have pointed out on many occasions, no theology, this side of glory, is ever perfectly constructed. And so with the Scofield Bible. Scofield placed a large extent of time in the creation week. As most, that is, most of those in that day, this was to accommodate the pressures of, we have the good word here, fake scientists who were mistaken in assuming the geological column to determine the age of the earth. You know what the geological column is? You know, you get an idea what it is? It's got layers of rocks in it, and then it tells you what of which layers, which and what how old it was, and they're stacked up in color, sometimes, you know, in living color. You know what? There is no such thing in the world. There's no such thing in the world. There's no column like that. But if you're a student in school, you don't know that. They don't point that out. Because what they've done, they've taken, you know, one layer from Kansas and one layer from Montana and one layer, and we need them in this order, so we stack them up in that order and say, now here's your column. That's exactly what they did. All right, so there's no geological column to determine the age of the earth. So Whitcomb and Morris comes along, 59, I think it was, or 60, and they reset the clock. And so it's not that old. We're back to Bible times. So Scofield retains some of the Scofield retains some of the historicists understanding the Bible, especially the seven churches in Revelation chapter 2 and 4, which are taken in sequence rather than contemporaneously. In fact, you'll see a lot of stuff that way yet. You see the church of Revelation in line, and we're in the last church, the church of Laodicea. And you look up, and I did, looked up a Scofield's reference Bible, and sure enough, church of Laodicea, it's our age, it's the last church. That's historicism. Remember, we look in the Bible to see the daily news. Okay, we don't do that. So he's a historicist to that extent. With the historicist and with the wrong understanding of Thessalonians 3:2, where it talks about the apostasy that comes first, they think that apostasy is apostasy from the truth rather than the rapture. It declared our present day the day of the Laodicean church. So those two went together where there's going to be an apostatizing church, and the Laodicean church was an apostatizing church, so that's the same thing. But that's being a mistake. So the notes are characteristic, non-sectarian. They don't talk about Baptists or Methodists or Presbyterians. It's emphasizing church as the universal body of Christ, not necessarily the local church. Although generally Calvinistic, Sofield's notes, when discussing the doctrine of election, emphasize a divine election based on God's foreknowledge of man's choice. We call that semi-Pelagianism. Remember, semi-Pelagianism. A full-Pelagian person doesn't believe that man has ever fallen. He needs also no help in his salvation at all. So he's a semi. He needs a little bit of help. Although Scofield himself lacked formal theological training, his reference Bible received almost universal acclamation from the evangelical worlds, including the scholars, because they had scholars who were making contributions too. There were additions in 1917 and 1967. Some of these erratas were updated. Some were fixed. The gap theory disappeared. Good thing that we don't have an infallible reference Bible that we can change. Now, other translations have come along, like, you know, Ryrie's body, with MacArthur has study Bibles with notes on them too. So, but Scofield's was the first. Not the first ever, but first that caught on. let me do this real quick. Can you? Maybe I'll go 5 minutes just to get it over with. One more here. For the fundamentals of the faith. In the year, Scofield published the Bible. Another generous layman, Stuart Lyman, a friend of Scofield who had contributed $1,000 for its publication. And by the way, in today's money, that's about $30,000. Quite a sum. Lyman launched a publishing venture, The Famous Fundamentalists. Earlier, he had helped. Earlier, this we're talking about, what year we're talking about here? It's going to end up being about 1910. So in the late 1800s, he helped found the Harrison Stewart Oil Company in 1886, the year that Moody started the Institute. 2 years earlier, their Adams Canyon number 16 well struck the first ever geyser in California. By the way, that's not the one. I just picked one. With the stock in the company mushrooming, the two consolidated their stock in the Union Oil Company of California. Bard, the richest man in the country at the time, became president. Lyman Stewart became vice president. Stewart soon succeeded Bard as president, which he continued to hold until his death in 1923. Going back now, 1894, when he became president, Lyman attended the Niagara-on-the-Lake Bible Conference. Steward being steward, that should be with a T, I think, became intensely interested in publishing of literature of this fundamentals of the Christian faith. A copy of James Brooks' magazine from St. Louis had providentially fallen into his possession. Now, remember, there is a vacuum here that we are not aware of. I mean, there is no literature that lays out fundamentalism or basic Christian doctrine. They're going to come up, what is the basic Christian doctrine? Say, well, let me think. You know, you just didn't have it. There was an earlier attempt to it before 1910, but it hadn't really been officially done, you might say. So finding the paper exceedingly instructive and helpful, particularly in its note of warning against apostasy in the mainline denominations, Stewart developed a profound burden for preserving fundamental Christianity, hindering the inroad of modernism. Brought up in a godly Presbyterian home, Lyman had learned to tithe his income. When attending a Sunday service where A.C. Dixon was preaching, that's Moody Church now, Stewart realized that he had found the man who could help fulfill his dream project. In 1909, same year, Scofield's Bible, Dixon was pastor of Moody Church in Chicago. Stewart and Dixon talked it over, outlined his ideas and methods and so forth, and Dixon responded, "Boy, this is an easy sell. It is of the Lord. Let's pray." I mean, that was really quick. Got him on board. So Dixon returned to Chicago and organized a committee of strong Christians who established the Testimony Publishing Company. They published the fundamentals. It is a set of 12 books, each about 125 pages, written by dozens of prominent Orthodox scholars from America, Canada, and Great Britain. The grand plan was to send these to every Protestant minister, evangelist, missionary, theological professor, Bible student, Sunday school superintendent, YMCA, YWCA secretaries in the English-speaking world. Copies went to 21 foreign countries. It took 5 years to produce the 12 volumes. 300,000 were distributed at a cost of $8 million in our terms. Many others helped in this project. Lyman's brother Milton helped, assuming half the cost. More would be said, could be said. R.A. Torrey was involved here as well, Moody's right-hand man. There were 90 articles written by 64 authors. The focus was a defense of Orthodox Christian faith. Current attacks, issues raised by modernism were addressed. It is impossible to determine the exact impact of the fundamentalists on the world. Well, Ernest Sandin, not a believer, but a good historian, said that it failed to curb the drift to modernism and helped prepare the evangelicals for the battle of the 1920s, which we will visit. All right. So theological looseness, we've just covered that. Do not judge 19th century by the standards of our excellent teaching. There was a soft and softer feel to their theology. This becomes apparent as there was no unified view of the cardinal issues of Christianity until later, which is why the fundamentals were written. Well, we get this kind of looseness, and I'm wondering whether we have not gone into another phase of it. Perhaps it's more like our post-evangelical church today. While there is an obvious loss of theology, and no one notices it, you know, so maybe repeating itself again. So, the amazing safety nets. First of all, the Lord sent 6 life rafts, 6 spiritual lifesavers that should have cut off modernism, or at least stopped it or slowed it down. First of all was this 2 million conversions in a 2-year period from Chicago to New York. That's a lot of people. And they were probably part of this, you know, somehow or another. So Moody's evangelism in the 30 years or 40 years that he ministered from 60 to his death, Moody's evangelism and the training of his schools in the schools still survive. That's probably the one thing we can still say. The Bible conferences left in dispensationalism. So that was promoted. That was another life raft. It was read your Bible literally, okay? The Bible Institutes flourished for a while, but seems now to be dying. You know, it's hard to know what school to recommend sometimes. We don't know many kids that actually go to Christian schools. All right. And then we have the Scofield Bible, which probably had the most impact of all because it got into the homes. And then we have Fundamentals of the Faith, which continues until perhaps 1950s. So I think 1950 is where I'm going to say that the evangelicals in the 20th century started to lose their way. Up until then, they did pretty well. Okay.